Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. This is the Reasonable Voices radio talk show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. Today, my guest is Kathleen Fuchs, Ph.D., ABPP, which is American Board of Professional Psychology. Is that correct, Kathleen?
Yes, that is correct.
I love the name Kathleen. Do you mind if I use it?
Please do.
Okay. Let me tell them about you first, and then I'll tell them how we met. Dr. Kathleen Fuchs received her undergraduate degree from the University of California, San Diego. She earned her doctorate at the University of Houston and completed an internship in clinical psychology at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She then came to Virginia for a postdoctoral fellowship in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Virginia. She is currently an associate professor of clinical neurology with the University of Virginia Memory and Aging Care Clinic. She is board certified in clinical neuropsychology and as such does cognitive assessments of individuals who have concerns about the onset of dementia. And that's what brings us here today. Kathleen Fuchs and I met at the Paramount Theater Saturday, August 15th, before a rather large live audience. Dr. Fuchs and I served on a panel of four, which included the author David Morris and the Central and Western Virginia Chapter President and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association, Sue Friedman. And we served on this panel to answer questions from the audience after audience and we viewed the very moving feature-length documentary about Glenn Campbell and his battle with Alzheimer's. I know that's a lengthy introduction, but I think we need to hear all of that so we know the real basis of this conversation is what you need to know about Alzheimer's. But I'm going to start off with a question that might confuse some, but I know you have the answer, Kathleen, and that is, what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia?
And it's a question I get all the time, so thank you for asking that. Dementia is actually kind of a broad term that doesn't imply a specific etiology or underlying cause. Mm-hmm. So when we speak of dementia, what we mean is that somebody's cognitive functioning is well below their normal level to the extent that their ability to do daily activities such as drive, manage finances, cook, or even keep track of appointments and such is compromised. So they are not functioning as they once were. Now, when we speak of dementia, we first kind of categorize, is a person at that level? Then we want to find out what is the cause of that dementia. Mm. And Alzheimer's is a cause of dementia, but that there can be other causes as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's the most succinct answer to that question I've ever gotten, as many know, seriously, and as you know, too, after Saturday, our panel discussion, both my mother and father suffered from Alzheimer's disease, and I wanted to touch on that in a way differently today with you than I have in other interviews, because of the questions we got from the audience. One thing that I said to Sue before thinking about it, I said, you know, everyone with a question started out really with the loss of someone, except one woman, and I want to talk about her. And I thought, it's a shame that everyone came because someone had already died. And then I remembered, looking at Sue, I said, you know, that includes me, doesn't it? We do need to try and get ahead of this, in front of this, and I understand that. But there was one woman who asked a question that several years ago, she thought she had already seen a difference in her father mentally and his alertness, but her mother kept assuring her that, no, that wasn't, you know, he wasn't having a problem. I'm going to get to a question for you, but the difference I want to touch on during this entire interview is how specifically my case seemed to be, if there is an easier with dealing with Alzheimer's, than a lot of the people I heard from the audience. But back to that question, how is Alzheimer's and dementia diagnosed? And getting back to the woman in the audience at the Paramount, if you really think someone is changing before your eyes, do you overrule other members of the family? How would you suggest going about that? And that will tie into how things were easier for me. Okay, I'll let you talk.
So, Marcello, how much time do we have here?
Yes, I know.
So, the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or other dementia is really a team effort because there are many factors that go into play. Usually a first stop for somebody, if they've noticed some changes in their memory, is they start to look at their peers and they say, you know, am I any worse than my friends? We all sometimes have trouble coming up with the name of a famous actor, and we all maybe walk into a room and we forget why we're there.
Yes.
This different than them. And that's the question that we have when they come to see us. Is the person in front of us showing changes expected with normal aging, or is this different? So normal aging things would be some slowing in how quickly we process information, more challenges with learning new information, a little bit of difficulty retrieving information like somebody's name or what a certain item is called. Those are sort of all normal aging changes, but we retain our reasoning capacity, our general intellectual ability. Those things should stay the same, and in some instances, they get a little better as we accumulate world knowledge and wisdom. But so somebody does notice some changes, they're concerned. Oftentimes, they're going to go to their primary care physician, who might ask them things like, well, what's the day's date? And remember these three words. And usually, people who are pretty sharp can pass those with no problem, even if they're having problems in their day-to-day lives. So a savvy physician might say, well, you seem okay to me, but let me refer you for some cognitive testing, or let me send you on to a neurologist to have that checked out. So what a neurologist is going to do is do a complete physical exam to determine if there are any changes in the nervous system that are apparent. The neurologist might also order an MRI or a CT scan to look to see if there are structural changes in the brain. They're looking for what we call atrophy or shrinkage in certain areas that might be suggestive of a cell loss in that area. And then hopefully they're going to send a person to somebody like me to do a full cognitive evaluation. And what I'm going to do with somebody is a bunch of paper and pencil kinds of tests and just look at that person and say, are you performing at the level that you should given your age and your educational level? And we kind of factor in that everybody has strengths and weaknesses, so we don't expect somebody to be doing well on everything. But if we start to see a lot of differences in a certain area, that may cause concern for us. So, for example, somebody may come in and do fine on tests of attention, processing speed, language, reasoning, but yet their memory functioning might be terrible. Then we say, this isn't normal aging. Let's take a look at this further. Now, the other thing I will tell people is if they come in and they're concerned about Alzheimer's disease, is I'll say, you know, the only way we definitively diagnose that is when we look at your brain tissue under a microscope. And when do you suppose we do that? And then they think for a second, and they realize, ooh, autopsy? And I say, right, I have yet to have a patient volunteer for an autopsy.
Exactly.
So what we do in life is we've got to take our best guess.
Yes.
And we take our best guess by ruling out any other medical cause for the cognitive changes we're seeing. So to kind of get at your second question, which was, you know, you're noticing some changes in your loved one. Do you kind of force the issue and have them get evaluated, or do you stand back and say, well, this might be okay? It's a hard question to answer because everybody's sort of family and relationship dynamics are different.
Yes.
I would say if you notice somebody is making errors that you're concerned about them getting into trouble in terms of their financial management,
mm-hmm.
having problems driving and putting other people at risk, having trouble living alone, maybe not eating as well as they should or maintaining their hygiene, or if you're concerned that they may be causing themselves some social embarrassment, it's best to have a one-on-one conversation in a gentle and kind way and say, I'm noticing things that are of concern to me. Why don't we just get this checked out and see if there's something that we can do to change this? Because I will tell you, a lot of times what people are experiencing is not Alzheimer's, but depression.
And that's something that Sue Friedman and I and of course, I saw many different physicians and when my parents were still alive as we dealt with things. And I want to throw in something I said on the panel discussion, that just because someone has dementia or is suffering from Alzheimer's doesn't mean they don't have physical issues, because one forgets and focuses and thinks it's only about the Alzheimer's disease, and someone can get a sore throat or twist an ankle or, you know, have a hangnail or whatever, and you need to be just as observant. For instance, my mother had blood clots the 3 Januaries in a row, and only because my brother mentioned as I was leaving my parents' home, he said, by the way, Mom said her leg hurt the other day. And only because I'd had great conversations with doctors that I spin around and I knew how to examine her leg, you know, if it's redder than, you use one hand so that one hand can feel the same thing. One's hotter than the other, one's redder than the other, one's more swollen than the other. And called the doctor, and he said, yes, Dr. Rolando, you got it. She's got a blood clot, let's get her in. So, go ahead.
It's actually a real common problem is people have urinary tract infections.
Yes.
Suddenly have more cognitive problems. They get a little delirious. They may even hallucinate. And we say, my goodness, get them to the doctor. It may be something as simple as a urinary tract infection.
Yes.
You treat that and they kind of bounce back.
Yes. And speaking of bouncing back, sometimes, you know, the further in, the longer the disease is developing, it takes a while to bounce back from any difference, like trying to get my parents, dad was pretty easy, but Mom was afraid about getting into the car and, you know, to go to the doctors, for instance. And then in this different environment, for a long time, they recognized their primary physician. And after a while, they recognized their neurologist as well. But you know, all those things, going into the hospital was the point I wanted to get to. And the doctors would tell me it will take longer for them to readjust.
Right.
I want to, the reason I wanted to, you know, I brought up the lady in the audience that asked that question is because as I listened to the questions from the audience, I realized I was different. First of all, my personality and profession is directing. So I'm used to telling actors how to perform, and they do it. Well, of course, I came back from New York thinking this was something I could direct, you know, a production, and all would go well, and of course, 12 years later. But my point is, because of my personality and my closeness with my parents, and I only have one sibling, and I have power of attorney for his particular medical issues, I was able, with just a call from an aunt saying, something's wrong, can you come check on your parents? And I saw things almost immediately that others would not see, and that was very fortunate. And I was the one who was the decision maker. But let's speak for a bit, if we could, about what happens when it isn't that easy. I mean, I had to have 3 conversations with my father before I didn't have to take the car keys from him, but I demonstrated to him and he accepted that. But every case is different and you have to be, as you said, friendly and calm and not aggressive. But when you've got a larger family, I mean, my family is larger, my father's family, and I had to tell them, you don't have to scream. They're not deaf. They have dementia, but they're not deaf. Tell us, how does the family deal? It is definitely a disease that's for the family.
As you say, every family is different. And it also, there are some people who are what we call on the front lines.
Yes.
They see their loved ones day in, day out. They see them declining. They get burnt out in their care. And then the out-of-town sibling comes sailing in, takes mom or dad out to lunch. They have a delightful time. And then they turn to their burned-out caregiving sibling and say, what is your problem?
What's your problem?
Mom
They're
fine.
Believe me, I've heard
what
that.
What are you talking about? Why are you taking away all their privileges? And so that can create quite the dynamic. I will also say, and this happened a little bit in my own family, is that it is often the out-of-town sibling who becomes the angel, whereas the one who's doing all the heavy lifting suddenly becomes the bad one.
Yes.
And that can be so hurtful and so difficult to deal with. But I will say sometimes, here's a funny thing, it's the in-laws who can make more headway with a loved one. So, for example, a lot of times when somebody comes into our clinic, they are brought in by a daughter-in-law. And the daughter-in-law will be able to speak a little more frankly because there isn't that dynamic of hurting my mother or father's feelings or usurping their authority in some way or something. Not always, but sometimes this key trusted person can make inroads with the person who's dementing.
Yes.
Now, I want to make one quick comment about the driving. You said, you know, you had a couple conversations with your dad and you were done. Well, that was a blessing for you because for a lot of families, this is a horrific issue to have to deal with. We had one woman whose husband, we told that he could no longer drive. He was not competent to do so. And so she took that to heart. He wanted to get in his truck and drive somewhere. She got her lawn chair out, set it in front of his truck, sat in the lawn chair, crossed her arms, and just kind of glared at him.
Wow.
Well, it was effective. He didn't drive, but we said to her, you know, ma'am, maybe that wasn't the
idea. Yes. You know, my driving story with Dad was that I spoke with him. He said, yes, he understood. Then another conversation, no, he wasn't going to give up. Well, the third conversation was really driving him in his old truck that he loved, two blocks away from his home, turning a corner, going down to the end of the street, making a U-turn. And then I got out of the truck and came around and said, now you slide over and you drive us home. And I got in and I feel terrible. Every time I tell that story, I feel like that was so hard, but I had to do it. And I was in the car with him and, you know, he just had to go up the hill and it was less than a quarter of a mile. And when we got to the top of the hill, you could see his home, 100 yards away or whatever on the left. And he sat and he sat. And finally he looked at me and he said, I don't know which way is home. And I said, yes, Dad, I know. And that's why you have to stop driving. But I let him drive. I said, turn left. And then when he saw the house, he turned in. And he gave me the keys. Now, that was not easy.
Wow.
But it's the kind... Yes, go ahead.
That is atypical, but yes, that was a good, tough love thing you did.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because every time I tell the story, I kind of feel like, you know what, but...
Well, and in fact, a lot of times what I do in my testing is I see that somebody's attention and their processing speed is such that I'm worried about their ability to drive safely.
Yes.
And I'll give them that information. And my preference is to give the information and let them and their families decide that it's not safe for them to drive.
Yes.
If I have serious concerns, I may say, you need to get a driving evaluation before you keep driving.
Yes.
And a lot of people kind of resist that, but sometimes when they're on the road in their own car with a driving instructor and the driving instructor says, here are all the reasons you can't drive, that's more salient for them than my paper and pencil test telling them that I don't think they should drive. The other thing I will do for families is I will write a letter to the person saying, I have told you you cannot drive, you should not drive, here are the reasons why, and I say, take my letter, put it on the fridge, and every time they start to get angry with you about driving,
yes, blame
point
it on
the
you.
Letter and say, it's not me, it's that mean Dr. Fuchs.
That's right.
But and the other thing I will tell them is, it's in your medical record now that you should
yes.
not drive.
Yes.
And if you were in an accident, and even if it's not your fault, but the other party had a smart lawyer, you would lose everything.
Yes.
And that appeals to a lot of people.
Yes.
Or the other one I pull out of my hat is, I say, you know, do you have grandchildren, small grandchildren? Yes. Do their parents allow them to ride in the car with you? And if they say no, I say, so they're not willing to risk your grandchildren, but they'll risk everyone else on the road? That doesn't seem fair.
No. It doesn't. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to start with you, Dr. Fuchs, if we could talk about how does diet, nutrition, and exercise affect brain health, and specifically if you have any opinions on the grain-brain diet, gluten-free. But we're going to take a break now. We are talking with Dr. Kathleen Fuchs about dementia, Alzheimer's, aging, cognitive memory, neurology, neuropsychology, all of it. We'll be right back. But mostly we're talking about families. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Attention to old school details is part of what makes David Robert Mitchell's new horror flick, It Follows, such a rewarding viewing experience. Nostalgia is a powerful force, especially in filmmaking. Cinema fans will appreciate the craft of the simpler yet compelling filmmaking methods of years past, before practical effects and genuine suspense were sacrificed in favor of predictable jump cuts, more explosions, more CGI, and endless chases. Jay, a young woman living on the outskirts of Detroit, has sex with her date, who then informs her that she has just become the new victim of a powerful curse. Something will always be following her, and if it reaches her, it will kill her. Seeking an escape from the curse, Jay turns to her closest friends for help in evading the mysterious phantom. Surprisingly, every element in this film converges into a masterful thriller. From Mitchell's assured writing and direction, to an incredible score by Disaster Piece, to Micah Monroe's praiseworthy performance as Jay. Monroe is stunning to watch as her youthful confidence morphs into terror and dread. But It Follows should not be confined within the horror genre. Fans will also welcome this one as a remarkable and nostalgic piece of filmmaking. It Follows. Not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio Show. My guest is Dr. Kathleen Fuchs, PhD, ABPP. We met on Saturday, August 15th at the Paramount Theater on the downtown mall of Charlottesville, Virginia, as two of four panelists who were answering questions from the audience. An audience that had just seen the full feature-length documentary of Glenn Campbell's struggle with Alzheimer's entitled I'll Be Me. It is most inspiring. It is, and that brings us to the arts, by the way. I do want to talk about that. But Kathleen, as I said before, I ended the last segment. How does diet and nutrition and exercise affect brain health? And if you can add to that your opinion or thoughts on this new book, The Grain Brain, A Gluten-Free Diet. And, well, where would you like to begin on those?
Okay. Well, I'm going to back up a little bit from your question, and then I'm going to dive into it head on.
That's
fine.
And
the first thing I will say is that we understand what's going on in the brain that causes Alzheimer's disease. It's abnormal deposition of certain kinds of molecules that the brain then just can't clear out.
Mm-hmm.
We think we understand why that occurs. Maybe some genes are acting inappropriately, not clearing the clutter, as it were, in the brain, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't know how to do is turn that off or clear it up.
Mm.
We also don't know how to modify somebody's genes.
Yes.
To make them not develop Alzheimer's. So the genes you were born with are the genes you have,
yes.
And there may may be some risk conferred by certain not only single genes, but maybe constellations of genes that we don't quite understand. So your genetic makeup is what we call a non-modifiable risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Now, from the moment you're born, there are things you can start doing to make your brain better. Mm-hmm. So you were born with what we assume to be a certain native intellectual ability, mm-hmm. but then you can take that and run with it by mm-hmm. getting good education and enriched environment. You made a reference to the arts a little while ago. I think that's important for developing somebody's brain, physical activity, and so on. So we go through life developing our brains, making connections, and so on. And then somewhere along the line, we realize, hey, we're getting older. Maybe we ought to get worried about what might happen down the road and start taking care of ourselves a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we know that we can do to take care of ourselves and help maybe delay the onset of Alzheimer's or minimize the impact of it is to take care of our hearts.
Yes.
And as you pointed out to Sue, and I say to people all the time, if it's good for your heart, it's probably going to be good for your brain.
Yes.
Because every single heartbeat pumps 20 to 25% of your blood to your brain.
Wow.
And your brain cells use 20% of the nutrients and oxygen in your blood. The rest of your whole body, which is much bigger than your brain,
gets
80%, your brain gets 20%. If that heart isn't doing its job, your brain isn't getting the building blocks it needs. So, of course, the number one thing that we recommend for people to keep their brains healthy is to exercise and keep your heart healthy.
Yes.
And I tell people, you don't have to go out and run a marathon. You just need to do good, consistent exercise that elevates your heart rate just enough to get it pumping a little more than when you're kind of walking around casually,
mm-hmm.
and do it consistently. Try to get in at least 30 minutes of that a day, or at least most days.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from various studies on animal studies and also human studies that people who exercise on a regular basis are at lower risk for Alzheimer's, and even those who start an exercise program, once they start to show signs of cognitive change, do better than people at the same level of cognitive change who then don't subsequently exercise. Exercisers over time have better brain volume, so they're not having as much shrinkage when we do an MRI on them,
mm-hmm.
and cognitively they're doing better. So that's one big thing you can do is exercise. Now, the other thing you can do is look at your diet.
Yes.
And we all know there are a lot of metabolic factors that impact your brain functioning, your heart functioning, everything.
Yes.
So things like high cholesterol, diabetes, they put you at risk for having potentially strokes or, again, an inefficient blood system going to the brain. So we want to keep a diet that's low in cholesterol, and we want to add in foods that have what we call antioxidant properties.
Yes.
And those are your beautiful, colorful foods.
Yes.
That have the omega-3 fatty acids, so your blueberries, your strawberries, your dark leafy green vegetables, you know, fish and salmon. And so what I'm talking about essentially is kind of the underpinnings of the Mediterranean diet.
Yes.
And some studies have been done looking at that, and it seems that people who follow a Mediterranean diet do a little bit better in terms of their risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
Now, you asked me a little bit about the grain thing.
Yes.
And I think the jury is a little bit out on that one. One of the hypotheses there, I believe, is that for some people, and maybe not all, some of the grains have more inflammatory properties for them.
Yes.
And so if you cut those out, the idea is that there will be less inflammation in the body, and that will probably be good for the brain. The thing is, unfortunately, I think what other people substitute for gluten isn't so much better for them. So people have to be very mindful and make very careful choices and actually consult with a nutritionist if possible before they just go up and buy the overpriced gluten-free products that they see on the store shelves.
Certainly they are overpriced. I can be a witness to that. But my wife is an amazing chef, and I miss bread. We've tried this. My hair is growing back. And I'm checking in. I want to make clear to our audience, I check in every 30 days with my primary physician because she knows, obviously, my body. She's taken my blood and all that sort of stuff, and just to make certain everything's okay. But I've heard wonderful things about the Mediterranean diet, and I think the lesson here is for everyone, and I hope you agree, but you let me know whether you do or not. The lesson here is lifestyle. And generally speaking, the American lifestyle is not, in my opinion, one of the things that keeps me eating healthy food, is that when I go to a particular type of food restaurant that caters to not such good food, and I look at the size of the people and the size of the portions, and I turn around and walk out the door. It is the greatest deterrent for me. We've got to understand we are what we eat, we are what we drink, and when we eat and drink it, we are how much time we sit at a computer or in front of a television, and we have to do something to change our lifestyle. Why don't you elaborate on that? I'm sure you've got...
I totally agree with that, and I will say also that while none of these factors individually may prevent you from having Alzheimer's disease, the issue is if we can delay the onset and impact of that for most people, as a society, we would save a lot of money in terms of medical care, in terms of nursing home care, and the stress that it places on family systems when a loved one needs a higher level of care. But, you know, the healthier you keep your body, the better you can withstand other problems that come down the road health-wise.
And, you know, that brings up a good point, too. I want to get to the arts specifically, but we are the prevalence we need to understand of Alzheimer's. Currently, there are more than 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, and that means more than 5 million American families living with Alzheimer's. Their siblings, their children, and I, with the event we just on which we just served the panel, I wish there had been more grown children with the elderly in the audience. I'd like to see more of that. Maybe it's too obvious to say it, but 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, do you think denial is still the greatest block to our breaking through here?
It could be, and I think some people, they kind of think, well, this has never happened to our family, so I'm in the free and clear. And you know, the thing is they're missing is that it's not just a direct genetic-linked disease. There are genetic factors, but just because nobody in your family doesn't have it doesn't mean that you're not going to get it.
Yes.
You can get what we call sporadic Alzheimer's. We don't know where it came from. You just happen to get it. But we know the biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age, and we have taken care of our health as a society more that more of us are living longer. Therefore, more of us move into the target zone of developing Alzheimer's disease.
Yes, all those baby boomers that are turning 70.
You got it.
And I don't think our government and our system is ready. People like you and Sue Friedman, and I guess to me too, because I've lived with it with my parents, we understand this is something, this is a time bomb, economically and medically. It needs to be addressed. We've always, as a society, since inception, you know, there's been voodoo about any mental illness. But Alzheimer's is out there, and baby boomers are aging, and we need government and the medical profession. We need to pay for research at NIH. Tell us about it. We are going to get to the arts, but tell me about this economic time bomb that's coming.
I mean, think about the cost of care. They are astronomical. Now, I will say most people with Alzheimer's are cared for in their homes by family members for as long as the family members can do that.
Yes.
But often what that means is some family member has stepped out of the workforce to do that.
Yes.
Or, you know, it is unpaid care in a lot of ways that they're doing that.
Yes.
Now, sometimes family members can't step out of the workforce. They have to bring in paid in-home care. There's a great need for not necessarily skilled nursing care, but even just companion care.
Yes.
Well, who are we going to hire to do that? Who are we going to train to do that? And that costs money. And insurance, by and large, often doesn't cover that expense.
Mm.
Well, then you go look for further on when somebody needs care and supervision 24 hours a day, then they usually have to go into some sort of facility. And as you know, those things can be astronomical.
Yes.
One person's salary is not going to cover that.
Exactly.
And again, a lot of folks, they might have Medicare or Medicaid, but that doesn't cover enough. And or people go, well, I'll just go to a place that accepts Medicare or Medicaid. Well, guess what? There are not that many beds available, mm-hmm. and those facilities might be far from where you live or might not be the kind of place you want to place your loved one. You'd rather have them in some swank happy place that you maybe can't afford.
And, you know,
so
even
it's a tough one.
Even some of the swank happy places, as we covered on at the Paramount,
mm-hmm.
you can't give the same treatment. I'll tell you, the only time I was fortunate, I could afford to keep my parents in their home because the doctor said the familiarity would help them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to hire 24/7 care and paid my brother to move in and live with them, etc. And he was my eyes and ears when I couldn't be there, etc. But that gets us to the arts, actually. I discovered that my parents, of course, or rediscovered or remembered that my parents loved old radio comedy shows, Abbott and Costello and Jack Benny and all those guys that, you know, the early TV shows in black and white, Sid Caesar, etc. Well, I found CDs of those old shows. And my parents would laugh hysterically, Dad slapping his knee, Mommy crying tears laughing, when they would hear these. And for that time and during that appreciation, also Car Talk, whenever I take them anywhere, they loved Car Talk. And I, even when Mom was having trouble with forming clear sentences. And by the way, they make a lot of sense sometimes if we just stop and listen, try to analyze. The words may be out of order, but I discovered they actually are making sense. They are to them. And if you just take a moment, you can hear something. But anyway, I had bought them recently a new TV, and we were in the car listening to Car Talk. And when we got home and I had to turn off the car, my mother tapped me and she said, them on that thing inside, meaning, and I knew she meant, the new TV. Can we get the Car Talk guys? So the point is that in some facilities or even some families, we think just plopping them in front of any show or any TV or anything, and it's fine because one size fits all, but it doesn't. You have to find what they relate to, because it does bring them back, at least for that. Am I overstating that, Doctor?
No, and in fact, I think what you say very clearly is moments of joy are possible.
Yes.
And it's important for families to think about quality of life. So
yes.
The two things I stress are safety. So make sure, you know, that they're not going to hurt themselves or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we go into a list of what that would be. But also, what do they love? What brings a smile to their face?
Yes.
And I had the opportunity a while back to be on a radio program with a man who created a book of photos for
uh-huh.
his parents
uh-huh.
and would walk through, you know, show the photos. And they were not photos that demanded a lot of you, but maybe could communicate a feeling.
Yes.
And that was very effective. And he said his mother would just look at these and touch the photos, and it seemed to bring her some peace and
yes.
some calm. I mean, it's a challenge to find these things, but for a lot of people, they are there. Or if there is an activity that person does that makes them feel useful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is still going on, but for a while, there was a program here in Charlottesville in which people with early stages of dementia could go and help stuff envelopes for charities.
Ah.
And they would have volunteers work at different stations with these folks. And these people would come in and go to, quote-unquote, work. And they had a job, and they interacted
wow.
with one another. And nobody demanded much of them, but they left feeling good about
yes,
themselves.
Yes, because that's the thing, I think. They must, especially with my father's case. He was not the kind of personality to sit on the sidelines. And I just felt he would get that look on his face like he just was worthless. And that's when
uh-huh.
we bring out the CDs, or when I'd tell a story, or I would sing, and my mother would shush everybody because they had to listen.
And the other point there is you knew what your parents liked. They
yes.
liked the old radio shows,
yes.
all right? A lot of times a facility will think, well, let's just get some music that was popular in the 30s and 40s and pipe it in, and everybody will be happy. Well, those yeah. might not be the pieces of music that those certain individuals responded to.
Exactly.
Or they may have enjoyed music of a slightly different era. I look forward to, very soon now, what we'll be hearing coming out of nursing homes is the Rolling Stones.
Yes, you know, I was going to say, that as baby boomers get older, there's going to be hip-hop you have to think about and you know, and other forms of music, because it's that it's their memory. And you know, I think I mentioned to you the other day, and I'm loving ending the show on some upbeat, because you can't just walk around depressed and blaming yourself and thinking something you did. You have to find those moments of return. Periodically, I would, for whatever reason, invite the family, even family I hadn't seen for years, come on over. I don't know how long they'll remember you. It's important to cherish these moments. And as you said, that day, we had Dad for an hour at the end, and if I have time, I'll tell you about that. But Mom, for some reason, that very morning came back, and complete with backseat driving, I took her out to breakfast. She saved our lives, pointing out a car that was coming out of its lane to hit me, which I didn't see. And that in alone was something. We had a great breakfast, brought her back home. People start arriving. She jumped out of the chair. She knew who everybody was. And I'm standing there with people I didn't even know, because these were people she knew, cousins and whatever she'd grown up with. Well, she was with us for most of the day. And many of my aunts and uncles stared at me like I was the crazy one. But then at the end of the day, she did sort of quietly go back. And then Dad, I saw him. I happened to be looking at him. All day he'd just been sitting, But he suddenly, boom, literally, his head popped up. He looked around. He said, "Hey, where did all you guys come from?" He went around, shook everybody's hand, and said hello. It was only a short time for him. It was all day for Mom. But it was beautiful. And one last thing, and I'll let you get in the last word. When things would get a little too somber around the house, I would just get up, leave the room, and wait for a minute, come back, and they would, "Hi, where did you?" They were happy all over again that I had just come to see them. So what hope like that can you leave us with from your vantage point?
Well, the thing that you've illustrated is that sometimes you just have to live in the here and now.
Yes.
You know, what's real is right in front of them right now. It does no good to say, "Oh, remember the time." No, instead pull out a picture and describe it, but you are right there in the moment. And the other thing I will say is it's important to savor those small moments, like you say, the little victories, and not beat yourself up that, "Oh, if I only did this, Mom wouldn't get agitated or Dad would feel better," or whatever. You do the best you can. And then when you have a little moment of grace like that, you're thankful for
That's
it.
That's right.
And you know the next day you might not get it again.
Yeah. It's so true. My parents were wonderful, darling people. My mother had a quiet strength. My father barely ever spoke except to tell her he loved her and to make a joke of something. He was a very funny guy. And I watched him in moments when he was not that. And we, as you say, as I would tell the caregivers even, you need to be here for the person who is in front of you. And that person may be different in 10 minutes. But right now, this is who that person is. And understand and respond. In any case, Dr. Kathleen Fuchs, it has been a joy and an inspiration to talk to you, really. It was great meeting you on the panel. I'm glad we both had the opportunity to share that experience of the Glen Campbell film. Again, everyone, it's I'll Be Me. The event, by the way, at the Paramount was sponsored by Our Lady of Peace Retirement Community. They should get a plug. They really did a great job with that. Thank you so much, Dr. Fuchs, being on the show. And we'll talk again for sure many times, okay?
All right. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Back in 2005, Hustle and Flow hit the Sundance Film Festival and exploded into that year's must-see film in the mountains of Utah. However, the story unfolds a million miles away from that idle setting, in the tough inner city of Memphis, Tennessee. But this is no shallow ghetto story. Yes, its central character is a pimp, but from the opening frame, we know that DJ, played with depth and nuance by Terrence Howard, has an intellectual core. We can't help but believe that born in a different environment, he would have found success in any number of respectable fields. But in his real world, he must choose from the avenues available to him. And he must dream the impossible dream, a ticket out through his art. Fortunately, DJ has the magic to inspire a disparate group of friends to join in pursuing his dream to create a rap anthem. Will DJ, with a bunch of whores singing back up, a quirky white boy with recording skills, and a church-going family man ultimately succeed? Hustle and Flow is a gripping film about the American dream, full of complexity and a richness of vision that will burn its story and its song into that special corner where we hold the films we love. Hustle and Flow, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Death of a Nation. On Memorial Day, we remember those who made the greatest sacrifice, but seldom acknowledge those who didn't, returning from battlefields, brain-damaged or missing limbs, to families changed forever. On Veterans Day, we wave our flags and parade in shrinking uniforms, celebrating those too often forgotten into When Johnny Comes Marching Home, to homelessness, underemployment, and VA neglect. On December 7th and September 11th, we remember sneak attacks but ignore our use of nuclear bombs. Bells ringing, we weep silently but praise preemptive invasion into a nation with no 9/11 connection because the world is a better place without its tyrannical leader, while failing to indict our own. Whether passing, loss, passed away, gone home, transference, moving on, crossed over, assumption, or ascension, some rise above death, while others crumble under the debris of denying the truth about death's war toll on the living. The few good wars, the American Revolution, 1812, Civil War, World War II, a maimed veteran can count on one remaining hand. Still, we praise leaders who systematically launch Americans off to fight for their country while counting the rewards of sacrificing our youth on the ensconced altar of corporatism. Truth decay is at its most devastating when denied the drill of eyes wide open to being cast as pawns in the chess games of the obscure. Sadly, the tragically tarnished, so proud of family members dying for their country, are consistent customers and constituents of the very puppeteers who profit most from wars, dead or alive. It's not national pride that is the enemy, but rather those who manipulate the Constitution to misdirect the valor of proud patriots. Until, like tattered old glory with faded colors, they become a forgotten symbol, denied truth with each deposit of war's perpetual blood, sweat, and tears. Most often, death is not quick to diminish our memories, fracture our relationships, or darken our doorstep, for death is not the instrument of destruction. That would be man's infernal grab for power, breeding insatiable need for more. As for the suits on the street tugging at five-sided foggy bottom and congressional bottom feeders, it's the thrill of rats racing to turn race against race, against being united, against peace. All for the high risk of risking others, they take another spin at the wheel of too big to jail. Death, like new life, comes with a tide of rigged oil spills erupting across land and sea like volcanic lava, coal ash, and tornadoes reshaping life and land. Death can be the pot of gold at the end of the middle-class rainbow for the wealthiest we built that. Death is the end-of-day last call of too many Americans ignored. Medicare refusing to cover cost of hearing loss. Congress keeping comparatively limited funding for Alzheimer's research at previous levels and proud that they didn't sequester it. Is it not more honorable to honor our dead by protecting Social Security for spousal survivors, finding a cure for those living maimed by war and underfunded NIH research. If a mind is a terrible thing to waste, then aren't the lives of veterans, firefighters, climate change scientists, military gays, and doctors defending a woman's right to choose? And how about unarmed minorities dying by police for sitting in their cars, making eye contact, playing with toy guns in the park, or bicycling while black? Death comes to America when patriotic phonies use religion to convince we the people that flag-waving is enough, while in some neighborhoods gun salutes mean mass incarcerations and unprosecuted murder of children in city parks and on public streets, to protect the wealthy few from losing their international power over our nation. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.